This is the story of five songs and their composer, who was once almost a physicist. And because we're already talking about physics, a little something about the nature of time itself. But before all that, a story about stories. See, there's this natural human tendency to think of stories as straightforward, because time flows forward. This happens, and then that happens, and then this is the result. It's logical, and it's tidy, and we do it all the time. In music, we have movements. We have verse, chorus, verse. This, and then that, and then this, expressed in notes. And when we create art to recreate life, we break our creations into acts and chapters and levels. Hollywood is famous for this. They call it the three-act structure. There's the setup. A farm boy is incited into action by some strange event. The confrontation follows. He overcomes ever greater obstacles, proves his worth. Then he faces a bleak moment. His mentor dies. He's not ready. All hope seems lost. Then the resolution takes care of the rest. He confronts the bad guy, destroys the big weapon, and saves the day. Thing is, real life doesn't always work out that way. Reality is messier than Star Wars. Except in the most literal sense, we don't live with a clear-cut beginning, middle, and end. Or at least, we don't realize it as it's happening. We just live. And most of the time, it's only the benefit of hindsight that brings our acts, our chapters, our verse, chorus, verse, into focus. But we can do that, right? If we muster the effort to sit down and make the commitment to be honest, we can take this moment right now to look back and figure out how so many other moments that can seem disconnected and random wind up telling our own stories. They're not as tidy as a Hollywood script, but our narrative exists. We can find it if we want to. But again, we only tend to get there with the benefit of hindsight. And all that hindsight really means is that time has passed and we're pretty good at looking back if we want to. But here's the rub and where the physics comes in. Time only works one way. That's not so much true for other dimensions. There's forward and backward, left and right, up and down. But not so with us in time. For all practical purposes, in the way that we experience it, there's no backward to time's forward, no left to its right. That's why we can't go back in time except in Hollywood and games and, all right, theoretical physics. It's make-believe. Except that's exactly what the composer Peter McConnell was able to do last year. Close enough for government work anyway. Peter McConnell's songs, like the one playing now, and his story are proof that we can rewind, if we're lucky and if we're blessed. And the best kind of rewind... is where we get to fix things we didn't like or mistakes we made. So we're going to tell you the story of Peter McConnell and the music he wrote for Grim Fandango. He's a composer who spent the last 25 years orchestrating video games, and last year, he traveled back in time. This is the story of the seemingly disconnected moments that led him from Harvard to LucasArts to Double Fine Productions. It's about the music he wrote and where it came from, and how in the late 90s he got so close to what he heard in his head, but had to live with the dull pangs of imperfection until one day, 15 years later, he returned to the land of the dead to perform a little resurrection. We're going to do that by taking a close look at five songs he wrote in the 90s and rewrote last year. We're going to travel to Switzerland and California and Kentucky by way of Treasure of the Sierra Madre and other film noir classics. We're going to learn about a friendship that sort of started by accident and lasted more than two decades. We're going to learn about jazz and so much more. But we're not going to be the only one to tell this story.
Hello?
Hi, Peter?
Yes.
Hi, it's Dave Tack.
Hi, Dave. How are you?
This is Polygon Wireframe, an in-depth discussion with the creative people who make the things we love. Maybe you don't know Peter McConnell by name, but odds are you know his work.
I've been writing music for games for longer than I'd care to admit, since about 1991 or so. There would be Monkey Island 2 and Indiana Jones 4, and I did a little bit of Sam & Max and Day of the Tentacle. Full Throttle was the first game that I did solo with Tim. And then was Grim Fandango, which is still popular. And I did some, X-Wing and TIE Fighter titles.
LucasArts fans will recognize those as a ton of the studio's classics. But like a lot of people who worked at LucasArts in the 1990s, Peter McConnell left and wound up doing a bunch of other work, too.
And then after LucasArts, a lot of stuff for Double Fine. So I've been very fortunate to work with Tim Schafer over the years and, games like Psychonauts and Brutal Legend, a number of other smaller titles like Costume Quest, which is wonderful. And then also some stuff for other publishers.
You can't find the exact same story, but boy, you can find similar stories all around the industry where people started at LucasArts and then wound up branching out. Now, if you didn't play many of LucasArts or Double Fine's games, that's no problem. There's plenty more he's worked on.
I've worked on the Sly Cooper series for Sony. It's a really great project. Big live jazz. Last score we did was 2.5 hours of live jazz music, or roughly big band / orchestral quasi jazz, I guess would be a more accurate way to say it. I've been lucky to do a lot of Plants vs. Zombies titles for EA, OpCap, and that is a really, a whole different vibe altogether. Super fun and very interactive and quirky score, and a wonderful original themes by Laura Shigihara to work with. And then also I've done some more work more recently with Blizzard doing Hearthstone. And that's been a really fun project, getting to play a lot of live guitar. I've been very fortunate to, stay in the biz, as it were, and write some very different kinds of music. I do enjoy writing a wide, wide variety of stuff.
Variety. Talk to Peter McConnell about music, and you can't escape variety. Mobile games, PC games, console games, games that cross all boundaries. Doesn't matter. He can do it. But to truly understand his work, you have to understand the man. Peter McConnell's path to becoming a composer winds its way through a lot of unexpected places. So let's start at the beginning, which for McConnell was in Switzerland. It's not just a setting, because the way he sees it, it's an important part of his journey as a diverse music lover.
Yeah, I mean, I absolutely love it. I mean, I've always been, some people say they like all kinds of music, and they mean all kinds of music from Led Zeppelin to AC/DC. And which I like that entire range too. But when I say I like all kinds of music, I really, there's almost no music I don't like.
I mean, it's not a huge surprise that a composer loves music, right? But what's interesting is where it comes from. And if you ask him, he goes back to Switzerland, where it all started, and then sort of everywhere else.
I mean, I just find music of all kinds to be very interesting. And I think it comes from having lived a lot of places in my life. I spent my early childhood in Switzerland, and so there was a sort of a very strong European influence there. I mean, my first memories are Mozart, of hearing Mozart on my dad's tape recorder, and also Sons of the Pioneers. You know who the Sons of the Pioneers are?
No, I don't think I do.
They are the great cowboy band from the 30s to the 50s, and they did such classics as The Tumbling Tumbleweeds or Cool Water or or Ghost Riders in the Sky, which has been redone many, 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 many times. Anyway, cowboy music.
Drifting along with a tumbling tumbleweed.
So I had this kind of sense when I was a little kid of, well, here I'm this American in another country. And I love this music around me, but then there's also this music from, you know, where I came from. And so I lived in Kentucky and Kansas and New Jersey, and along the way acquired a taste for bluegrass and Bruce Springsteen.
Well, I mean, if you lived in New Jersey, I think it's probably, you have to like Springsteen by law.
Yeah, you have to. They kick you out if you don't like the boss.
So there's young Peter McConnell growing up outside of the place that he knows is home, and he's developing this love of music that connects him back to home. But it's not just about listening to music. It's also about playing.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I was classically trained on the violin growing up, and I played a lot of sort of folk instruments like banjo and guitar. Five-string banjo was the first instrument I played that, I would play until my fingers bled. So I had this real strong affinity for highbrow, you know, whatever, so-called serious music, and also decidedly unserious music.
So at this point, it seems obvious that he's going to grow up to be a composer, except that it wasn't actually so obvious. When it came time to grow up, his first instinct was to take a more scientific approach. He went to Harvard, and he didn't study music, or at least not at first. And you can blame, in a weird sort of way, his life's course correction on Yo-Yo Ma, who, in case you don't know, is a famous cellist.
Yo-Yo Ma was playing under my feet, literally, because in the house I had, the sort of dorm I lived in, he was the music tutor.
See, the thing to remember here is, he's not studying to be a musician, but he has this idea that he is a musician.
I sort of consider myself to always have been a musician. I mean, I was singing before I could talk, and I just, music has always been sort of like something that's central in my life. But I kind of came to it professionally pretty roundabout.
So he goes to Harvard, and he's studying to be a physicist, and there's Yo-Yo Ma under his feet.
And I didn't go down and hear him play because I had a physics problem set. After sort of the smoke blew over from that, I started questioning my priorities. You know, my guitar would sit there for a week and not get played. And I liked physics well enough, but it wasn't moving me the same way music did.
So there's this crisis of sorts in his mind, right? Am I a musician? Am I a physicist? So what does he do?
So I took a bunch of time off. I ended up coming back to major in music.
So he settles on music, but he's still living this somewhat dual life. He's splitting his time and focus between technology and physics and music. And when he got out of college, he got a job that personified that dual life, actually. He worked at Lexicon, which is a company famous for creating effects for audio production.
You know, they make very famous reverbs.
It seems like the perfect fit. This is the right combination for the guy who loves science and music. Except it wasn't, because he got restless. Music was calling.
And so I was working there, and at night I was playing in bands, and sort of trying to figure out, well, you know, I'm working in the audio industry. This is cool. How can I, you know, do more music?
So in the meantime, while all of this is going on, his old friend and roommate, Michael Land, moves out to California because he got a job in the LucasArts sound department. And that leads, like the Yo-Yo Ma incident, to another pivot point in McConnell's life, where things become clear, where restlessness turns into a plan. And this is the one that changes everything. This is the one that determines the course of the next 25 years of his life.
He was like, you know, you should really come and check this out. This is really interesting stuff we're doing. And so then I saw my first graphic adventure game. And I couldn't believe, I mean, I'd sort of been raised on Zork. This is a long time ago. And I couldn't believe, wow, you know, people are really doing this. You know, they're doing something cinematic on a computer. How cool is that? And so I sort of found a way to make this transition where I was, designing audio software with Michael, and then we got to actually write music to make the, you know, that the software would play.
So now he's at LucasArts, and he stays there for a while.
Stays there for almost a decade.
And during that period in his life, he started to spend less and less time writing software and more time writing music. And the man most directly responsible, if you want to quote Terminator, or at least a man who plays a very big part in the next chapter of McConnell's life, is Tim Schafer.
No time.
Right.
Podcast jokes.
That's him.
This is Tim Schafer from Double Fine Productions. And years ago, I made a game called Grim Fandango, which had amazing music by Peter McConnell in it.
Now, at this point, Schafer and McConnell have worked together so much that they have a relationship that's sort of like George Lucas and John Williams. Every time George Lucas made a new movie, which is really just a Star Wars movie, he called up John Williams because that was his guy. Steven Spielberg has the same sort of relationship with John Williams. Peter McConnell and Tim Schafer are like that.
And I have started to look a little bit more like George Lucas as years go by.
But of course, that's today. It's not the end of the story, but it's 20 plus years into it. It starts in the 90s back at LucasArts.
Way back at LucasArts, you know, Peter and I were just employees of George working in the games department. And I think the first thing we ever worked on was the first time we worked on the same project was Monkey Island 2. I don't think Peter was on the first one, but the second one had Peter McConnell on it. And he and the other, the three guys from the music department, Michael Land and Clint Bajakin and Peter, formed what was sometimes referred to as the Harvard debate team. There were these, a couple of them were from Harvard, and they like to talk about music theory, and were also C programmers, a few of them, maybe all of them. And they wrote a system for interactive music called iMuse that helped all the background music in the original Scum games.
So there's McConnell and his buddy who brought him out to California, and Tim Schafer, and they're all working at LucasArts, and they're all working on adventure games. It's easy to take this stuff for granted today. But in the 90s, in this era, hardware was just getting powerful enough to do things both visually and audibly that hadn't been done before. So you've got this group of Harvard guys over here in the music department who also know an awful lot about programming, and they're inventing the technology to make this stuff happen, while Tim Schafer and other people at LucasArts are writing and directing the games. So you got a bunch of games out of those collaborations, but you also got partnerships. And maybe the most lasting one is with McConnell and Schafer.
I can't really explain the chemistry with Tim. I'm just super lucky that it exists. I've always really loved his writing, and I think he's also appreciated my sense of music.
He's very flexible.
There's Schafer again.
Style-wise, which is something we always valued in our visual artists at LucasArts. Like, we really, you know, like, now we're going to do a Chuck Jones cartoon game, and now we're going to do a biker adventure, and now we're going to do this Day of the Dead thing. Like, we really need our artists to work in any style that we say, you know. Now we're going to do heavy metal album covers, you know, it's always great when you work with an artist who just loves those kind of new challenges. It's like, that's crazy. I've never done that style before. And then they do it. And Peter has that same gift with music. You know, we're like, now we're going to do this biker. I mean, you know, we need some biker music. And then we need some comic cartoon music. And now we need some bebop. And now we need some swing. And now we need some Mexican folk music. And, you know, now we need some symphonic classical, you know. And Peter's always like, yep, got it. Like, if you say, like, okay, I need bebop mixed with Mexican folklore plus a little bit of swing. And then he's like, yeah, let me, like this. Blum, 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 and he plays it. And yes, exactly.
See, we're back to variety. Little Peter McConnell growing up, moving around, finding all kinds of music he likes. And then there's Tim Schafer, who has all these influences and all of this variety. And of course, it seems obvious in hindsight, like everything does, that when they meet up, they realize it's a good pairing.
I think also maybe because it may be also because he's very eclectic himself. You know, he draws from just a wealth of culture when he's, you know, when he writes a story. Grim Fandango certainly comes to mind with influences as diverse as Glengarry Glen Ross, Casablanca, and City of Lost Children.
So obviously there's this mutual admiration, and the two became friends, even outside of the games they made and the work they did together.
I think we must have some compatible sensibilities. I like the guy. He's really fun to hang out with. And we like to talk about topics outside of games a lot. You know, I think that was something that is indicative of adventure games, too, which is that they are about life. And in the broader sense, they're not just about, like, the topics that action movies are about. They're about topics of the world. So Peter and I can sit around and talk about philosophy and world history and whether or not there's a God, which is something we always fall onto. And then also get back to music.
So they're work partners, and then they're friends, and then comes the perfect storm, as McConnell calls it. A graphic adventure game, like the kind LucasArts had been making for quite a while now, except this one came along at sort of the exact right time to do a lot of things that they couldn't do in other games. So that gave the artists on one side a lot of opportunity, and it gave the composer, Peter McConnell, the opportunity to do a lot more on his side. Plus, to sort of tie it in a little bow, Grim Fandango has tons of influences, tons of variety, in other words, which works pretty well for both Schaefer and McConnell.
That game, in so many ways, was a perfect storm. It came at a time, and I wouldn't say it just descended upon us. I think Tim sort of divined it at a time that all this stuff was going on. I mean, there was a jazz sort of resurgence, and there was swing was hugely popular. And at some point around then, I don't remember whether it was during Grimm or shortly thereafter, Big Bad Voodoo Daddy played in like the Super Bowl or something like that. So that'll give you an idea of, you know, how big that swing scene was. So there was that. There was also, I think, a real sort of growing awareness of Latin culture that there hadn't been before. A kind of a revival of retro things, too, along with the swing thing.
When Peter McConnell starts talking about the work that he did on Grim Fandango, he doesn't start with his own music. He starts with the broader culture and how that influenced the music. In other words, it's not just technology and it's not just the game, but Grim Fandango to him is a reflection of the culture of its time. Now, for his part, Schaefer is writing the game and overseeing it. And he writes this story that takes place in the land of the dead, the literal land of the dead where people go after they die. And it's tied in heavily with the idea of the Mexican Day of the Dead festival. So you've got your pretty obvious musical influences there. But Grim Fandango goes a lot of places. It doesn't just stay in one location or draw from one influence. So as Schaefer is figuring out his game and figuring out the kind of music he wants for it, he has a conversation with Peter McConnell.
Peter's more just talking about the game, first of all. Like, what is the story of the game? He wants to understand what this game is going to be like. What's it going to look like? What's the theme? What is the tone? Is it a comedy? Is it serious? And what are its inspirations, you know? And if we can talk about a movie like Sweet Smell of Success, you know, is a great old movie that influenced the dialogue a lot. And then that's a starting point to look at the music and look at that great jazz score for that movie and just talk about common inspirations like that. And pretty soon you both start just talking about things that inspire you and you get excited. And Peter pretty soon is having ideas and sending in themes and off and running.
So Schaefer tells McConnell about the game, and it's this throwback to film noir. And film noir means jazz. And jazz, in the mid to late 90s, is having this resurgence, especially in San Francisco.
All up and down Valencia, there were clubs, or Valencia and Mission Street, there were clubs that played all kinds of cool music, and especially swing and acid jazz. And so you could go down there and maybe catch, you know, Tom Waits' reed player, who actually ends up playing on Grimm, and go around the corner to a taqueria and hear a mariachi band play. And literally every musician who played on Grimm played that district regularly, from the Andean flute player who lived there to Bill Ortiz, the trumpet player, who's now playing with Santana. He played all those great trumpet lines. There were a bunch of players from a band called the Red Hot Skillet Lickers who were playing a lot in the Mission in those days. So there was literally, like, all I had to do was drive downtown. There was the Grimm score.
So he's got a giant pool of musicians to choose from. Now he's got to write the music. Here's Tim Schafer, the writer and director.
And he recorded me talking about all the rooms, and then he put them together in this interactive hyperlink. I think it was like a hyper, what is it called on the Mac in the 90s?
HyperCard.
HyperCard deck, yeah. I feel like he put together this HyperCard deck, if I remember correctly, where he could click on different rooms and hear me talk about the rooms, and then he would gradually replace my voice with the music that evoked that same feeling. So I think he's one of those artists who's really committed to just getting it right, like just figuring out what is the deal, and then how to, and then nailing it.
Now it's time to actually write the music, which is a somewhat difficult task to describe, but not impossible.
For me, a great deal of composition is just getting into that state or recognizing that feeling that you're ready to listen to some music that's going to play in your head.
So it's something that needs to be done, but it isn't exactly something that Peter McConnell can force. He has ideas, he studies, he knows the story, he knows the characters, he knows their backstory. And then
what it does become, I think, is just an awareness of, you know, when you're ready, what parts of the day are you likely to have an idea? What things are likely to distract you from that? And just sort of clearing your head out so that you hear that melody. And for Grimm, I did have, since I was in-house, I had one luxury, and I really do try to duplicate this as much as possible. It's a little harder to do when you're independent, but as much as possible, I try to duplicate this one thing, which is plenty of lead time so that you can come up with the basic melodies. And so I had a handheld tape recorder. We still used tape back in them days. And I still have the handheld tape recorder. I'm not sure if it works, though. I would have this handheld tape recorder, and it was just always on me. And I would go for my walks in the morning, and if a melody popped into my head, I would sing it. And then I would sit down and maybe play it on the piano. And then that eventually, if that nugget seemed solid enough, I would dub that little me playing the piano in a really awful tape quality, and I would send that to Tim.
He would often hum them, but he'd often hum them while he played the piano. So he would have these old recordings of him on Psychonauts playing themes, and he's like singing along with the piano. And he'd work on. He approaches it in a similar way that I approached the story, which is to work on the backstory. Like I figure out who all the characters really are, you know, and who they were before the game started, you know, and what their histories are. I try to figure out like who they all are, what their parents were like. You know, that's just like a writing method that I've always found helpful.
And that's how Grim Fandango got made. Little bits at a time, long morning walks, and that was it. Grim Fandango is generally regarded as something like the apex of the age of the graphic adventure games. That's not to say it was perfect by critic standards or even by its creator standards, but the game did achieve many things that games like it and before it did not. Peter McConnell's relationship with his work on the game is a little complicated. There are things he loves, and there are things that he never loved. And that's why what happened last year, when Sony swooped in, when Disney allowed it, when Double Fine remastered the game, was so important to McConnell.
I probably wanted to do Grim Remastered from about the day that Grim was released for the first time.
See, it's complicated. Here's how he strikes the balance between what he likes and what he knows could have been better.
I mean, first of all, I was extremely proud that we were able to do that much live music in the first place. So I was very psyched about that. And you know, I don't know if you remember, but it was a sort of a time when, I mean, live music in game scores was not really, I mean, it was there, but it wasn't really big yet. So I was really psyched that we were able to do live jazz recordings in Grimm, and those recordings, I really loved them. They were played by awesome players, as I mentioned before. They were mixed by a fantastic guy who had tons of experience mixing serious records at Russian Hill Recording in San Francisco. But there were so many things about that score, in particular the orchestra parts, that still made me wince, to be honest with you. I mean, you know, you have this grand moment, and then what you hear is, gee, you know, is sort of, well, I'm not a real score, but I play one on TV, you know. It's wow, gee, that sounds like kind of interesting music. I wonder what it really sounds like, you know. That's kind of the feeling I had about the sort of what are supposed to be these big cinematic moments in the game.
So, constrained by budget and technology, it's a good score, but it's not exactly what he wanted. And it wouldn't be until 15 years later. That gave McConnell the opportunity to use modern technology and ancient technology like real human beings to create not just a remastered game, but a remastered soundtrack. When you talk to Peter McConnell about it, 5 songs come up. Casino Calavera, which is a song that is as much about how much McConnell loves jazz as it is about the game it's in. There's Grim Fandango, which is a direct homage to a lot of black and white noir movies. And there's some Lawrence of Arabia in there, too. There's Hector Steps Out, which captures the original era of swing music and its resurgence. And there's Swanky Maximino, which, interestingly enough, comes from a melody that existed long before Grim Fandango. And there's La Mancha Sub, which is this interesting combination of a chase sequence and Mexican folk music. Here's where they all came from. Starting with Casino Calavera, which is all about jazz and kind of starts at Harvard.
Well, you know, when we talked earlier about my background and also the circumstances under which, you know, Grimm came to be, one thing I didn't mention is how much I love jazz. And I'm not really a jazz musician. I consider myself more or less a sort of classically trained rock and roll player. But in college, I took a course, an amazing course in jazz called History of Jazz. But the point of it was that you actually had guys who, the course consisted of real players coming in and talking to you about, you know, their experiences. And some of these guys, you know, Illinois Jack Kett and John Schofield and a guy named Milt Hinton, who played bass with just about everybody, and Al Hurt came in, you know, really amazing trumpet player. And they would just come in and they would talk about, you know, here's my experience being a musician. And the textbook for the course was the Smithsonian Collection of Classic Jazz. And I have probably listened to that, you know, hundreds and hundreds of times. And it just, I love that music from starting from the 20s and basically ending in the 50s. That era of jazz to me is just so awesome.
See, this is one of the advantages of being a composer. When a project calls for it, you get to write in a sort of style and express yourself in that style in a way that you might not have been able to before. And that's what Casino Calavera is.
It's very much taking a cue from the small band stuff that Benny Goodman did. And see, during the war, the bands got smaller.
Yeah, I guess they would.
there were these you know, little groups that were Benny Goodman and Charlie Christian on guitar, who was one of the, you know, early great guitar heroes. The whole history of the music is so fascinating. But anyway, the point is that there were these wonderful small ensembles in that era, and that is trying to catch that spirit. And then they were very sort of jam-oriented. You know, it was very simple chord structure, and then the guys would take off on it. Count Basie is another good example. There's a lot of Count Basie in that song. So you hear sort of the attitudes of Benny Goodman and Count Basie. And also there's sort of an Ellington's less Basie-esque attitude of the piano. It's very, very, very sparse, partly because I'm an awful piano player. And partly because that's what's called for by the tune. It's just the lightness. This is was an example of a tune that I was really able to revisit for Grim Remastered. It originally was just a verse, a chorus, you know, and then you were pretty much in back to the verse and you were out. So it was like a minute long. I don't know if you've heard the old version, but the new version, I put two solos in, and with amazing players. I was able to do a much, much better piano parts, which I just replayed everything. We recorded some new players, a young guy named Shane Norman on trombone. He just played a fantastic solo. Also, we did bass clarinet with Sheldon Brown and clarinet with Sheldon Brown. He plays that amazing clarinet, the sort of Benny Goodman-esque solo at the end that really just makes the tune what those tunes were really like when we were cooking. So, yeah, very exciting to be able to sort of add those elements and make that piece really shine.
So you took what was basically like a one-minute best I can do and turned it into, well, you doubled it.
Yeah, pretty much doubled it.
And turned it into sort of more of a whole song.
A proper jazz tune with jamming, you know, proper solos, basically, and really just fine ones. That was very cool.
Now, Grim Fandango is different. It's not jazz, and it's actually more sort of orchestral and even maybe Persian. So where did that come from, and why was it different?
I had, you know, looked at a lot of these black and white movies from sort of classic noir days, and also sort of adventure movies like Tres de Sierra Madre. There's a sort of a Hollywood sound of the exotic. The theme, Grim Fandango, was the first piece I wrote for the game. It might have even been the first melody I came up with. That I can't say for sure, but it was very early on. And I was thinking about movies like Lawrence of Arabia and Treasure of the Sierra Madre, like Spartacus, you know, the epic movies about a fantastic, far-off or ancient land. And also, I used to play in the youth orchestra when I was a kid, and one of my favorite pieces that we played is called Capriccio Espanol. There's just this sort of sound the sound of a Western orchestra portraying a far-off place that I was really trying to capture with that. And that, you know, it's pretty hard to do when you're just playing on samples. So I was very happy that we could do that as a you know, the real way, you know.
And that real way is with the symphony, the same symphony Double Fine used to make Broken Age.
That was all live with the Melbourne Symphony.
So this is McConnell fixing not mistakes, but righting wrongs.
This was really a chance to kind of take the gloves off for them and, you know, do a sort of a powerhouse kind of number. I thought was, it came off quite quickly. Yeah, they tore it up.
Well, what was it like for you to finally hear what you wanted?
Well, you know, it's I mean, it's great. You know, you know, when you, if something's been, it's like, let me start over again. It makes you tongue-tied. It's wonderful to you know, finally hear something the right way and to say, yeah, that was the way it was supposed to sound. You know, I knew it was going to be good, you know, kind of thing. You know, it was also, I mean, satisfying from every stage. You know, from just, you know, looking at the original files and working out, gee, you know, this is really what the way the instrument should be doing this, rather than the sort of fake version of that one does quickly when one's sort of emulating an orchestra under the gun, you might say, to actually being in the studio and hearing the sounds come out of the speakers. I mean, my second favorite sound in the world is an orchestra tuning up, you know, and then the first favorite sound is the orchestra playing the piece, you know. It's great.
So how about Hector Steps Out?
Yes, Hector Steps Out, and that is a showcase for Bill Ortiz, who is the trumpet player on the original project, and he was a trumpet player for the Red Hot Skillet Lickers, who were this wonderful jazz band, wonderful sort of swing band, in a kind of a Cab Calloway / Billie Holiday kind of vibe. He now plays with Santana. Just a wonderful player. We had him play this sort of jam over the solo section for this tune when we originally did it. It may have been because of size restrictions in the game. I can't remember why. We had to actually cut it a little short and edit it so that the beginning of the solo was not in the game or in the original soundtrack. And so it was kind of nice to be able to stretch the piece out and have his entire solo be heard.
Huh. For the first time?
Yeah, for the first time. It's such a fat sound. He really is kind of the master of that stuff. I'm just always loved all the trumpet on Grimm has got this kind of real, you know, big, sassy quality to it that's just really awesome.
So next up, La Mancha Sub and Crushed, are those two?
It's two cues, yes, and that's Melbourne Symphony. This is a great example of where the original version had this sort of what was supposed to be epic music, because this is giant sea battle that you're having with an octopus and you're on a submarine. And it should be like, it's really, in terms of the action, it's probably, you know, one of the biggest points in the game. And, you know, and what we have are these little sort of emu samples playing, you know, clank, clank, clank. And, you know, when I went through the score originally, I was like, boy, we got to do that one. You know, and I like the piece because it's got sort of a, it does have a little bit of a Latin vibe, but it's still sort of also, you know, Western action music. And it has the change up of the time, and, you know, it's really aggressive music. It's just great for people really playing. You know, you just can't get that kind of crunch, crunch, crunch of fast-moving, high-energy, high-impact music. Can't get that without real folks, you know, pushing air in a room. So it was very satisfying to do that. And then almost it's like complete other side of the coin is the second half of Crushed is after the sea battle. You're in this Mayan Andean setting. Going across this big plain and almost sort of sacred feeling. What we have is Clint playing guitar. So that's the original guitar track back from 1998, played with Melbourne Symphony. So I got to tease Clint Bajakian recently about his performance with Melbourne Symphony. Give him lots of praise for it. it's interesting because that's something that you can do. People generally will do with a sample because, oh, you know, it's just a few notes playing and playing softly. So we can fake that, right? But boy, when you get real people doing that, you just have that feeling of, wow, I really am in the Andes.
And last up, Swanky Maximino.
Swanky Max. That's one of my favorite tunes just in general. That I actually wrote that melody, at least the part up to the bridge. I wrote that long before Grimm was ever started. I was just psyched to be a young guy working at a job where they were actually paying me to occasionally write music. That was pretty cool. And I think it was in the middle of Day of the Tentacle, I just suddenly heard this gangster melody. I'm like, wow, man, if I ever do a gangster piece, that would be a great melody for that. And I wrote it down on paper, kept it in a little notebook. You know, a couple years later, probably more than a couple years later, it was probably like, you know, 4 years later, something like that, when Grimm came along, it's like, yeah, you know, maybe I'll get to do that gangster melody. And I did. So just the tune is a favorite of mine sort of for that reason, because it actually was inspired music that came even before the game existed. It's in the vein of sort of early Duke Ellington in his Cotton Club days, in some of the sort of more sort of low-down kind of vibe that you'd have with the bowed bass. It's got bowed bass, which is cool, and a lot of low wind. And one of the nice things about the remastered version of this one is we were able to replace... There were a couple of samples creeping around in there still, a couple of fake horns and couple of things that were not the real deal, and I was able to throw all those out and have real trombones playing all the trombone parts and a real bass clarinet and a geeky wonderful player named Sheldon Brown. Really knew that vibe very well. And so just make it really fat and if you listen to the two, it's kind of interesting because I think the first time you hear the two, the old version, the new version, you'd be, oh yeah, well, it's nice. The new version sounds better. That's cool. But if you really listen to it the second time around, you'll be like, wow, that is so much sassier and swankier. So yeah, I was very, very pleased with what we were able to do on that one.
Well, it sounds like there's that sort of human element, right?
Oh, yeah. I mean, and, you know, and the idea of playing jazz with anything but real people is kind of sacrilegious. So I was able to atone for those sins.
So here Peter McConnell sits 15 years later with an almost completely new version of his Grim Fandango soundtrack. It's something... like he said, he wanted to do for a very long time. And now that he got to, how does he feel?
I think the main thing is I just feel so lucky we were able to do this. It was the number of people who had to, you know, who said yes when they could have said no. The number of people who worked overtime. The number of people who, you know, just put blood and sweat into this project is just phenomenal. I mean, the original Grimm, I just remember being such a massive effort. And when I was finally done with it, I walked out to a park and lay on top of a picnic table and looked up at the sky and just watched the clouds go by for like a solid hour. And I was just so wiped out from that crunch. And you know, the new version proved to be every bit as every bit as much as a behemoth. So there's just something about it that is, you know, giant and takes over everything, but it's worth it.
Our thanks to Peter McConnell for taking the time to talk to us, and to Disney for allowing us to use the songs that Peter McConnell wrote. The remastered Grim Fandango soundtrack is available to purchase in storefronts like iTunes. In the meantime, you can hear Casino Calavera, Grim Fandango, Hector Steps Out, La Mancha Sub Crushed, and Swanky Max at Polygon.com. You can find a link to that in the show notes and in the article at Polygon.com. This is Polygon Wireframe. I'm your host, Dave Tack. Thanks for listening.